Myanmar's recent banking laws has sparked widespread concern among locals and business groups. That's because the law, rolled out in early April with immediate effect, requires all foreign currencies to be changed to the local chat.
Yeah, the impact could be huge because this instability that we're seeing, as well as the threat of sanctions, could really discourage international companies from doing any business there. Most of Myanmar's foreign business ties are in Asia, but condemnation by Western nations could still have a ripple effect.
Moving on, the war-torn nation of Myanmar is already struggling under the weight of high inflation, a falling currency, and power and labor shortages. Now, the World Bank predicts that the country's gross domestic product GDP will contract this fiscal year. In a study released on Wednesday by the World Bank, the situation is predicted to worsen in the aftermath of Typhoon Yagi in September. The bank predicts a 1% contraction in Myanmar's GDP for the current fiscal year ending in March 2025.
Before we hear from our upcoming guest, I want to address a sensitive topic that carries horrific implications. It concerns landmines and the well-documented practice of the military to force villagers to walk ahead of soldiers in landmine-contaminated areas, using them indiscriminately as human minesweepers. It goes without saying that this butchery is a grave violation of humanitarian and human rights law. No one should fall victim to these terrible and indiscriminate weapons, especially children who are among the most vulnerable. But the problem of landmines in Myanmar goes way beyond that. So in response, we will be launching a new series of podcast episodes titled Navigating a Minefield. Each monthly episode will examine landmine issues from diverse perspectives to inform, educate, and inspire action. More information is available on our website, including risk education materials produced by our humanitarian partners, which we encourage listeners to share to promote safety measures for at-risk communities and raise awareness about humanitarian mine action. It's a difficult topic, but a very important one. Thanks for listening, and now let's get on to today's guest. Goldstein, thank you for joining us here at Insight Myanmar Podcast.
It's my privilege. Nice to talk to you, Joe.
So you were the country director for the World Bank in Myanmar for several years, several extremely impactful years, and we're going to get into that. But before we get to that phase of your life, could you first start by sharing a bit of your personal and professional background that led you to that position so we have a better understanding of what you were coming into with?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, basically, I was a development warrior. I mean, I grew up in a family that really put a lot of emphasis on serving others and doing good in the world. And I was supposed to be a lawyer, and I disappointed generations of lawyers in my family by choosing instead to go down the path of being a development warrior, of trying to work to create a better world and to reduce poverty overseas. So that led me into a very short-term assignment for the World Bank when I was 25. But the short-term assignment turned into close to 35 years at the World Bank. I've also worked for some other notable development organizations like USAID and the African Development Bank at various times. But I essentially spent most of my career at the World Bank. And I, you know, went up the hierarchy of what was at the time a mostly male-dominated organization and rose up into positions where I was heading up World Bank offices, first in one country and then later for groups of countries as a director. So after stints in, you know, the Balkans, in Africa, in other parts of South Asia, I was ultimately named as the country director for Myanmar, Cambodia, and Laos, and I was stationed in Yangon around about middle of 2017.
Right. And as you write about in your book, Damned If You Do, there's also this misperception of a misunderstanding of what the World Bank actually is and what it does. And you describe how there's a combination between some justifiable criticism that should be responded to alongside some misunderstanding, a misperception as to what it actually does and what it's supposed to do. So can you begin by unpacking, give us like a World Bank 101 for dummies, which I probably fall in that category, of what the World Bank actually is and what it's doing. And maybe pushing back against some of those misinformed criticisms while also looking at where you would acknowledge some fair criticisms.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think if we talk about World Bank 101, and I think most of the world can use World Bank 101 because it's not very well understood that the World Bank is actually what's called a specialized agency of the United Nations. It's not an agency of the United Nations in the same way that World Food Program or UNICEF are agencies of the United Nations, but it's a specialized agency. What that means is that it's part of the larger United Nations family. At the same time, it has a very different structure and voting situation than the rest of the United Nations. In the case of the World Bank, the mandate of the organization is to reduce poverty on a livable planet. And it is an organization that is owned by member governments, just like all of the UN agencies. It's owned by member governments. So those governments sit on the board of the World Bank. What's different from the General Assembly of the United Nations is that it's not one country, one vote. The voting shares are weighted by the financial contribution of different countries into the World Bank. And by convention, the United States has always been the largest shareholder with about 17% of the vote. And then there are other shareholders that are smaller shares of that. So that makes it quite a difference. And I think what people tend not to understand sometimes is that means that the World Bank, in doing its work, it lends money to countries, and it lends money from its public sector side with a sovereign guarantee, and then through the International Financial Corporation, it does private sector operations. But what people generally think of as World Bank loans, these are loans with sovereign guarantees, which means by definition, you are working through government. So we don't have the option in the World Bank to just take our money and work only with, say, civil society or non-governmental organizations. We, you know, that can only be done because these are loans that are given to the government, and it becomes, you know, it is the government's funding. And they must do things that they believe are right, and they implement them. The World Bank does not implement these. The World Bank just supervises or provides support to the implementation, but it's actually government that has the legal responsibility to implement these operations. So I think that's also something that tends to be misunderstood about the World Bank, is that we directly implement particular projects, when that is rarely, if ever, the case. And number two, that we have the freedom to step outside of the governmental system in the things that we do.
I want to ask a somewhat loaded and sensitive question based on the response you gave, which kind of fast forwards us in some ways to the potential end of the conversation in where we get to and understanding your time in Burma. But I think it's also it could be helpful to have this as kind of a preface or way of understanding what you're about to step into, because in some ways these are general developmental issues and World Bank considerations, but yet they took on, as many things do when they come to the Myanmar space, they took on an even more intensified and exaggeration, extremity when it was involved in Myanmar, especially the time that you were there. And that question is looking at, like, development for what sake is a way to say it. When I spoke to Chris Milligan recently, who was the director for USAID in Burma, also during the transition period, and asked him about USAID's policies, he made clear that the development they were trying to do was very much aligned with the direction that American interests had Myanmar going at that time, which was the democratic reform, the human rights, the economy that was helping marginalized communities, et cetera. So it wasn't simply he clarifies in that interview, it wasn't simply doing good developmental practices that would help in certain cases in a vacuum, you know, in what they were trying to do, but that they were not doing things that would just further empower those people that had reigned over a very corrupt and unjust system for so long, but developmental, specific developmental concerns that were getting at the heart of the kind of change they wanted to see Myanmar go through. And so that's a Myanmar specific question, and we'll get into all that later, but just kind of grounding us into the Myanmar context, if you could talk about, because I know this is something you talk about quite a bit in the book, is in some ways having some understanding and appreciation for these policies in the World Bank, and in some ways kind of pushing against them and criticizing them. So it is a very nuanced, sensitive issue to examine. But if you can talk about how the World Bank, given that its funding does come from governments and governments oversee the project, to what extent is it looking at just development that's helping marginalized communities for the good of helping them? And then to what degree there's kind of strings detached or higher aspirations, or this is part of a larger, sometimes political process in nature as well?
Okay, lots to unpack in that question, as you rightly said. I think it is fair to say that the World Bank defines its role. And again, I don't speak officially for the World Bank at this time, but I am speaking as someone who worked with the World Bank for, you know, close to 35 years. And I would say that the World Bank has a very clear mandate to focus on shared economic growth, meaning growth that benefits broad swaths of society and that reduces poverty. And that's a good thing for the most part. But at the same time, and I think it's common knowledge that many observers of the World Bank say, well, you know, it's been used as a tool of foreign policy or a tool of Western liberal values. And it is certainly fair to say that all of the UN agencies and specialized agencies like the World Bank reflect the views of their members and take on the political priorities and agenda of their members. So the World Bank has always been seen as a way to further many of the sort of Western liberal democracies' foreign policy goals. Some would say the United States' goals. And it is true that by convention, the World Bank has a united, president from the United States. And so therefore, that's a very powerful point means that and of course, the World Bank is located, three blocks from the White House. So it is certainly the case that our largest shareholder at the World Bank has an important say in what is seen as important in the way that we do development, where we do development, et cetera. So I think it's, you know, it's a fair criticism or at least an observation that the World Bank, just like every other development agency, is not a politics-free or a foreign policy-free zone. And that does affect what happens in places, especially under such extreme circumstances as we faced in Myanmar back in 2017-2018.
Now, getting to your time in Myanmar, your appointment there as country director was a big deal. It was a big deal for Myanmar. It was a big deal for you, obviously, in your professional career. And it was even a big deal in, as you described, the male-dominated workplace in the World Bank, at least at that time. And the fact that this promotion was being given to a woman was, one can also argue, within World Bank culture, it was a big deal for that. So unpack this appointment and kind of what it meant for all these different parties and sides.
Okay, well, certainly from the perspective of the World Bank, it was something of a big deal, we thought, because I was the first director level individual appointed to Myanmar. And let me explain what that means. Up until that time, we had reopened our office in 2012 or 2013 there after the sanctions were lifted and the reform agenda was moving forward. But at that time, we had what's called a country manager there on the ground. And that is a head of the office, but it's at a slightly lower level than a country director. And typically, the smaller or less consequential countries are those that have a country manager. And then countries that are larger, more consequential, tend to have the country director based there. So the decision to, and prior to my going there, the country director had been based in Bangkok and was part of a and Myanmar was part of a larger group of countries that were being serviced by a country director out of Bangkok. The decision to put a director in Myanmar was seen as a symbol by the international community of the increasing importance of Myanmar as the country re-entered sort of the global economy and moved toward both a more market-oriented economy and a more democratic type of government. So it was seen as something of a reward and an aspiration that Myanmar would become a major player in the global arena. And so they put the director there and added Cambodia and Laos to that grouping of countries. And it was seen as a big deal at the World Bank. I'm not really sure that the government of Myanmar ever understood that as well as we thought they might. Or felt that it was a big step up for them. In terms of my own appointment there, I should say that I didn't actually get a promotion to go into this position. I was already a country director, so it was a lateral move for me. But it was a plum assignment. And the reason it was a plum assignment and I was so excited to go is that by end of 2016, Myanmar, with so much promise and so much enthusiasm about how this country was going to be, you know, the next big democracy and become an economic powerhouse, all of that enthusiasm meant that Myanmar had become the fastest growing aid program at the World Bank at that time. So it was a very exciting time, and there was quite a lot of resources, both technical and financial, that we had at our disposal to help Myanmar move forward, and we were extremely excited to do that.
And then the politics came. they came in Myanmar with great force, and they came in the World Bank with great force, and that is something we'll get into. But before that, it's funny. We've done so many of these different interviews with people that are coming in from backgrounds of being ambassadors, or, you know, as mentioned, director of USAID, or entrepreneurs, or journalists, or whatnot. And there's these checkpoints that every Myanmar story goes through, and in some ways, the checkpoints are There's a thread running through them of similarity that, you know, of the slow steps of the transition, when the transition started in full after 2015, the kind of Wild West atmosphere, the Rohingya crisis, the, you know, the aftermath of the Rohingya crisis, the 2020 election. It's just, these are the checkpoints that all these stories pass through that are somewhat anticipated, but also unique to the perspective of who was actually in that position. And so as we go through those checkpoints, we'll start with your story and your background at the World Bank. And that, yes, so you, as you just painted, in a general sense, you come into a situation with so much potential, so much excitement. It seems the sky is the limit. There's so much happening there. And so if you can pick up from that thread, and before we get into the politics that tore it all apart, but just at the moment of what did you walk into? What were your perceptions? What were the issues that were apparent, and what were you trying to do about them?
Yeah, thanks. Well, let me start, and it's a really interesting and excellent question you've asked, because I will start by saying that the World Bank has had quite a large amount of experience in after, for example, the fall of the Berlin Wall, which now maybe sounds like ancient history, but I lived through that and I worked through that at the World Bank. And we've had a great deal of experience in moving countries that were quite isolated and what we would call sort of economic autarkies, and that were under socialist or communist regimes, very command and control economies. We've had quite a great deal of experience in transitioning those economies toward more market-based and more globally integrated economies. And that's essentially, I think, how initially the World Bank walked into Myanmar thinking, oh, that's what we're dealing with here. And in some respects, those that were there, I wasn't there at the time, but those that were there were correct that there were many aspects of the Myanmar economy that needed to be treated exactly like any other command and control economy. And so a lot of the initial reforms that occurred, you know, things like liberalizing exchange rates, modernizing the banking system, opening up markets for things like telecommunications, these were very sudden and very big reforms that had a huge payoff. And they were very positive. And they are still very positive, by the way, to the extent that they've been maintained. They're still very positive. So that was the sort of good news about what we were doing. And the other piece of good news that I would say about what I walked into is that there was a great deal of focus on basic services for the population. And that included things like expanding electricity, whether it was through the national grid or through various mini grids and you know, solar options, but expanding electricity, expanding health and education, getting money down to the local levels of health and education facilities, not just in the regions, but also out in the states, including areas that were not necessarily under the control of the regime, even at that time. So those were all some very good things, and we saw some great progress in that respect. So now maybe if I can jump ahead and say, you're probably now going to say, so what did you see that wasn't so wonderful? And I guess what I quickly understood, and again, when we get into what you call the politics, it'll be very obvious, but what I already understood soon after getting there was that it was not necessarily enough to just focus on reducing poverty in an aggregate sense in Myanmar. And the reason for that is that you could generate economic growth. And in fact, you know, growth in Myanmar rose to between 5 and 6% a year, which was really excellent growth rate and led to some really wonderful changes in social welfare as well. You could do that for many years without necessarily reaching the people who are in the most severe poverty and who are the most severely deprived. And that was all of the ethnic minorities who were out, you know, on the ring, the outer ring of the country in the highlands, in very remote areas, or in Rakhine State, for example. In other words, the World Bank could succeed in its mandate in the sense of generating growth and reducing poverty, and that would all look very good. However, we weren't necessarily taking into account who was in the most severe poverty and the reasons for that poverty, which was rooted very much not only in questions of remoteness or lack of infrastructure, but also in systematic exclusion, discrimination, and abuse of civil liberties and human rights. So that wasn't as front and center in the way we tended to look at the country. And that was something that we needed to correct over time. Okay.
Right. So I would also like to ask you, before we get into really what erupted with the Rohingya crisis and beyond, you obviously came in knowing about the ethnic tensions and the potentialities for things to go south. I don't think anyone quite predicted how south they would go, but for those that were working and knew the context of the country, that was obviously there from the history of discrimination and much worse on the part of the regime. So it was, even before that, it was a dicey, delicate situation, to say the least, and then with the 2008 Constitution, no less as well. And so what were your strategic plans and visions for when you came in, of what you were trying to do and what you wanted to see happen?
Yeah. Okay, good. When I came in, there was a strategy in place. So it wasn't as if I could come in and immediately write my own new strategy. That's not how it works at the World Bank. There's a certain amount of continuity in the sense that the people who were my predecessors had devised a strategy 1 or 2 years earlier that theoretically was going to last for another couple of years. And one of the interesting aspects, because you know, the main priorities of that strategy were to modernize the state, basically, things like the budgeting system and the banking system, how these things would actually function. The second priority was really to free up the private sector to help to stimulate growth. And the third area was really to focus on basic social and infrastructure services for people throughout the country. And that meant throughout all regions and states. So, the priorities were, I think, fairly laudable. I mean, I think they were the right priorities. An interesting aspect of that earlier strategy, which was then severely affected by what happened later, is that what was foreseen at the time was to focus on public sector modernization and private sector liberalization, if you will, or reform, through what's called two lines of budget support. And budget support is a very different animal than typical sort of donor-funded projects, in that budget support is money that goes directly into the government's treasury, and it is dispersed right into the government's accounts after the government has undertaken a set of reforms that they have agreed with the World Bank as being helpful to achieve the goals of, say, modernizing public finance or reforming private sector and liberalizing the private sector. So there was a plan to put a lot of money, we're talking, you know, well over $1 billion over the course of the next 4 or 5 years directly into the government treasury in order to fund a process of economic reform in both the public and the private sector. That was what was planned when I got there. And in fact, the first of those operations, which had been linked to reforms in public finance that were all done, by the way, you know, moving to change the way of preparing the budget, of executing the budget, and of controlling the budget so that money could actually go out and you could track it for things like education, health, et cetera. All of those reforms had been done, and we were ready, in fact, to disperse the first amount, which was $200 million, which would have gone directly into the government's budget. Now, that is a different story than our many projects. For example, we had projects like $400 million to support rural electrification. That is project money, which is spent specifically on goods and services needed to execute the project. That money is in separate accounts. It is not in the government's accounts. So it's quite a different kind of oversight.
That's helpful to know. Now, when you describe this this transfer that that would go to the government of Myanmar if they met certain requirements for it, you use the conditional. You said that the $200 million would have gone, which indicates that maybe things didn't go exactly as planned. What happened with that?
Indeed, it did not go as planned. What happened is that in August, there was the escalation of the Rohingya crisis. And just for any, I think most of your listeners know precisely what I'm referring to. But as we can recall, after an attack on certain security outposts by ARSA, basically, there was a very outsized response from the military at that time, which led to gross human rights abuses of killing, torture, rape, arson, and then the forced displacement of 750,000 Rohingya, many just fleeing on foot and across the Naf River into Bangladesh. And that continued from August through about December of 2017. And it was truly horrific. And there wasn't a lot of information flowing at that time. But what we could see from satellite photos and other sources of information, it was quite horrific and worthy of international condemnation, which in fact happened. Now, all of that was happening at a time when the Ministry for Finance and Planning in Myanmar had undertaken already, before August of 2017, they had already undertaken all of the reforms that we had asked them to undertake to modernize the public finance system. They did a great job. I was very proud of what they were able to accomplish. The $200 million had been approved by our board of shareholders to be dispersed. It had not yet been dispersed because there are some procedures that need to happen before you can actually disperse the money into the treasury accounts. Typically, it will take anywhere from 2 to 6 months to get those procedures done. So we were kind of halfway through those procedures when the Rohingya crisis escalated. And then the question arose, of course, well, do we disperse this money into the treasury? Now, there's kind of two ways of looking, well, maybe more, but at least two ways of looking at this. One was that this is a legal contract, which it is. It's a binding legal contract that had been signed with the government, that they do these reforms, and when they do these reforms, we disperse the money. So in that sense, of course, we should go ahead and disperse that money. The other way of looking at it, though, was the way that I think most observers would have seen it, which is, okay, the Myanmar government, and there was no distinction made in the outside world between the civilian Aung San Suu Kyi's part of the government and the military part of the government. You know, here you have a government which is engaging in gross human rights abuses, not yet labeled genocide, gross human rights abuses, and the World Bank has just rewarded them by sliding $200 million into their account. So this, you know, this view that the World Bank, this somewhat uninformed view, if I can call it that, because obviously there were details behind it that would explain why we would do such a thing and why it was legal to do to actually disperse, was nonetheless the dominant view that we were somehow rewarding the military for undertaking human rights abuses. And that was something that I felt we was not the right signal to be sending, that we needed to send an important signal to the government that what was going on was not appropriate. But this was very, very controversial inside the World Bank because for several reasons. One, because it felt like we were breaching a contract and we take rule of law quite seriously at the World Bank, number one. And number two was a sense of we were mixing in human rights and political issues that are not really within the mandate of the World Bank.
That's really thorny. So, and I think this anecdote, along with so many other that you others that you share in your book, and I'm sure will come up in this conversation, also kind of go towards indicating why you gave it the title that you did. Is how many decisions there's really no right choice from, and that's one of the things we, you know, you did in your book. We handle on these podcasts is try to have these nuanced conversations, getting into the details with informed individuals that were that I think one can be outside a system and just have a blanket criticism for why don't you just do this? Why don't you just do that? And indeed, that was something you describe even in the book from higher ups at the World Bank that are not so much having the nuanced understanding on the ground that you're having, but are just wanting to do or say something or see something that just feels good, whatever the effects of that will actually be. And so getting back to this 200 million, then just staying on this for a moment, then moving on from there to talk about this difference of kind of working inside the system where there are so few good choices and, you know, the outside perception of that. Well, what did happen with that 200 million?
Yes, it was hotly debated inside the World Bank. The teams devoted to public finance were quite up in arms because they rightly said, you know, they did everything. They did everything right. And we signed an agreement. It's a legal agreement. You know, how can you abrogate this, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, I strongly felt as director that there were two actual reasons that I took the action that I did. One was I felt that the perception was just simply too negative. The signaling was too negative, even though behind that perception, I knew that this money was going to the civilian government, that if anything, at that time, we were hopeful, we were optimistic, perhaps foolishly optimistic, that the civilian parts of government wanted to remedy the Rohingya situation, wanted to do the right thing. And so in many respects, I was perhaps punishing the civilian side of government, which desperately needed those resources to push back against the military. That was one argument in favor of my going ahead with this disbursement. But I chose not to do it because I felt the larger perception was a problem. But there's also a second reason that was very important for me as well. And that is that at the time, the president of the World Bank was making noises, if I could put it that way, about needing to do something quite radical to push back against what the military was doing. He felt, you know, very, very strongly that this was the wrong thing, you know, terrible thing to be doing. And he felt that we needed to send a very strong message to the Myanmar government. He knew Aung San Suu Kyi, had met her personally, and was feeling very disappointed by what was happening, seemingly under her government, even though, as we all know, who know Myanmar, she did not, you know, the lady did not have a great deal of power to oppose the military at that time. But he perceived it as she was in power, and yet here they are abusing the Rohingya minority. He was very unhappy with that. And so one of the reasons that I chose not to disperse this budget support is that I felt we needed to do something that would send a strong signal, and yet at the same time would not hamper our ability to help the civilian government address the conflict going forward. In other words, do this rather than, say, freeze our existing portfolio, which had operations doing community-driven development, education, health, all over the country, including in Rakhine State, including in townships that were majority Rohingya. So I did not want to tie our hands in terms of how we help the civilian government, both with our existing portfolio, which, you know, you hear 200 million, you think that's a lot of money, but I had a portfolio of more like $1.2 billion already there, and then, you know, a billion or more a year that could come in going forward. And I did not want to jeopardize those billions by failing to send a strong signal with this 200 million. So I chose what I considered to be the lesser constraint, and therefore did not disperse the budget support, which was something that I think the Ministry of Finance and Planning never really understood the reasoning. But we did it anyway, and I will hasten to say that in the end, it was the only aid program or project or intervention that was canceled due to the Rohingya escalation.
So a large part in that decision was around this idea of wanting to make a strong statement to want to let the dissent and the disgust be heard and registered, with the hope that that would ultimately be able to nudge or push the government, again, government in quotes, because this is such a nebulous issue in Myanmar at that time as to who was controlling what and who had control over what. And you talk to people in that administration, and you know, they express being kind of terrified every day that they could even keep going to their office and any degree of freedom, and how careful they were being as well. But there's this strong statement, and that's something that we hear from all quarters, from people that we've talked to, from so many different backgrounds and perspectives, this sense, this moral outrage that wanted to be expressed. But one of the dynamics there is this distinction between wanting to have a moral outrage that's expressed and registered and hope that that will do something to nudge the needle, and then really understanding the reality as it's unfolding on the ground. And I think as we look back now, I would say I'm more pessimistic in looking back at those years, in the sense of, is there anything that could have been done at that time by anybody with any dialogue that would have been able to shift the extreme levels of propaganda, militarized propaganda, the use of Facebook and disseminating that, the widespread discrimination that even many Democratic activists and legislators were also carrying the sense of isolation. If anyone in Myanmar at that time started to feel this almost belligerent sense of isolation, as it was almost like the more the international community started to come down on it, the more resolute they were in feeling that they and only they really understood what was best for their country and what their true history was. So, you know, looking back on it now, kind of judging all these things together and looking at what that decision was. And again, we have to look at the counterfactuals. It's not that that just because the other decision would have been made, we don't know what parallel track of history that would have developed on. But with the hindsight of 2020, looking at that decision now, and maybe this is another case of damned if you do, where you don't have really any good decisions in front of you. How do you look at that decision in 2025?
I actually stand by my decision in the following sense. I do think that had the money gone in, we would have heard from activists throughout the world that the World Bank was rewarding the most egregious human rights abuses. And one hopes to avoid that kind of press. But also, I stand by my decision because, as the story goes on here, we will discover that, in fact, despite a lot of threats and a lot of discussions internally, the World Bank, rather than shutting down its portfolio and its lending, never did that, and instead changed the way that they did business. And I ultimately believe that staying engaged, but focusing on other things, in this case, focusing much more on social inclusion in conflict areas, and specifically on those severely deprived ethnic minorities, I believe that that was the right strategy for Myanmar at the time, and still is the right strategy for Myanmar. Obviously, right now, the situation is completely different under the military junta, but in terms of how one approaches the task of poverty reduction in Myanmar, I believe that while I, you know, lost the battle in terms of I lost that budget support, I, in a way, won the war in that I succeeded in keeping the World Bank engaged in the country up through, well, even today it's engaged, but staying engaged in the country, but changing the way that we did business so that our strategy would be more aligned with the real needs of all the people in Myanmar.
Yeah, and there was a real danger at that time that, as you alluded to, that the World Bank would just say enough of this to express real moral outrage. We just want to pull out completely. And that's where, you know, you're dealing in some ways, you could say you're dealing with extremism on all sides, on all sides of the decision-making process.
Yeah, we didn't really know if that, you know, there was a lot of talk of this. And the president of the World Bank at that time felt very strongly that he wanted both to make rather bold public statements, things like, you know, New York Times, op-eds, etc., about the lack of acceptability or you know, condemning in the strongest of terms what was happening in Myanmar by the government, again, making no distinction between the military and civilian parts of the government. Wanted to have that, you know, high level moral outrage on record, and at the same time, at least thought about pulling out entirely. So-called rolling up the carpets was the expression that was being used, that we should pull out to express our outrage. And that became really the heart of the debate that we had in our own office in Myanmar, but then also in the larger World Bank, about do you stay or do you go?
Yeah, right. That's a very common argument that comes to Myanmar, and today it's taken on a completely different dimension. But to just stay on that argument for the moment, as you were present in Myanmar through the World Bank, can you unpack how that argument was playing out and what the different sides of understanding was on and looking at that situation?
The senior management of the World Bank proposed that perhaps we should roll up the carpets, which meant, in World Bank terms, freezing the portfolio, not doing any new lending and projects, and then conceivably, although it was never all that clear, actually shutting down what was a brand new and quite beautiful office in Yangon. So that was what was on the table. Now, at the same time, there were a lot of other voices. Again, if you recall, I said that the World Bank is owned by its shareholder governments, right? So while there are some dominant voices like the United States, Japan, China, and other Western powers on our board, you really have to listen to all the voices. And so what I discovered when I would go back, well, I would talk to ambassadors, for example, while I was in Yangon, and then I would come back to headquarters in Washington, D.C., and I would talk to the actual board directors, the executive directors who sit on our board, who represent these different countries. And interestingly, all of them, from extremely different perspectives, throughout the entire height of the Rohingya crisis, which I would say, you know, was from August of 2017, you know, onward all the way through until the coup, basically, all of those shareholders were of the view, for varying reasons, that it would be better for the World Bank to remain engaged than to pull out, regardless of the military's actions, which everyone agreed were horrendous and worthy of our, you know, contempt and of our action, really. They all felt that the World Bank should stay engaged, but they did ask us. They said it can't be business as usual. For, you know, especially there were many Muslim majority countries that sit on our board who said, you know, they're killing Muslim minorities, so we need to see the same kind of action in, you know, whatever the World Bank would do if they were killing, you know, minorities of other religions. You know, we want to see the same level of activism and action and outrage here. And so that was one point of view. Other points of view from many of the Europeans were that, you know, it was absolutely essential that we shine a light on these human rights abuses, but the best way to do that was to stay engaged and to focus very much on this issue of exclusion and how we work to build inclusion in the country. You know, that would be a typical view from many of the Western European donors, some of the Nordic donors. You had others, players who are, you know, who know the region very well. For example, Australia, which you know, knows very well the Asian region, whose view was, this is horrific. This is quintessential, fragile, and conflict-affected states. This is, in fact, what we pay you to stay in and do, which is to stay in and figure out what is best in the long run for the peaceful and prosperous development of this country. We know it's messy. We know it's high risk. We know that there are bad things happening, but we actually need you to stay in. So lots of different points of view and lots, you know, lots of different voices. I will say that the first Trump administration, which was in power at that time in the United States, also felt we should stay engaged. And their dominant their dominant rationale for that was that they understood, or at least felt, that Myanmar was an important buffer between China and India, and that the World Bank could help counter the influence of China in Myanmar. And that was something that the Trump administration wished to pursue. So all in all, for very different reasons, all of these shareholders said, stay there. And yet the president of the World Bank was threatening to pull out.
That's an incredible insight into what it was like for our listeners to be there at that time and hear all these different views replayed back from what was such a difficult and sensitive decision. And yet that decision to stay there and to engage with the hopes of strengthening the civilian government, knowing that that there was this bifurcated rule of the military engaging in the direction of the atrocities and what the civilian government's doing, we can come back to in a moment. But the idea, at least, is that however imperfect it is, to be a force for trying to prop them up as the best chance that was there. Although the criticisms for doing so were intense and emotional, and in your case also very, very close to home, because you relay a scene in your book where you're having a meal with your family and describing your rationale for what you're doing. And you quote your daughter as saying to you, well, yeah, but you're complicit in genocide. And so being and you also reference, I should say, in your book continually, being of Jewish heritage and having the Holocaust, the memory of the Holocaust as such a poignant family discussion and remembrance of something that happened in this world and our own place in this world, to look for those warning signs, to know that history and do something. I mean, I couldn't imagine a more devastating indictment or accusation than hearing that. And, you know, I also think it's quite brave of you to put that in the book as well, because, you know, that is quite a vulnerable thing to reveal, this exchange. How did you feel when you heard this from your daughter, and how did you respond?
Honestly, I felt sick to my stomach, and I had to leave and be by myself for the rest of that day, because I was worried. You're right that I, as a Jewish as an American Jew, I was a Reformed Jew in my case, I was raised on what I refer to as, you know, Holocaust tales. And what this meant is that literally every year I would go to Sunday school, and not only would we learn about the Holocaust, but we had to see the Holocaust. I mean, we were shown whatever footage was available of, you know, concentration camps, you know, Nazis shoveling bodies into open pit graves, the survivors looking skeletal and gaunt, and just horrific pictures for young children to be viewing. And yet we viewed them every year. Because the, you know, what was drilled into us by our parents and our rabbis and our teachers was basically that it can never happen again. And that if you don't say anything, if you don't speak up for whatever, for whomever and for whatever, then it can happen again. And that was drilled into me from my childhood onward. And so I feel a very strong moral obligation to speak up whenever I see what I perceive to be, you know, unfair, bordering, going from unfair all the way to, you know, horrific genocide, human rights abuses, etc. You must speak up. You must do something. So to have my daughter summarily decide that I was complicit in genocide, I really had to think through again my logic for taking the position that we should stay. And you know how it is when you have to explain things in great nuance.
Yeah.
you know, then you sort of ask yourself, am I over-explaining? Am I justifying? Am I actually complicit? So believe me, it sent me on a lot of soul searching. At the same time, I did arrive. I still came back to the fact that this was not about, for me, whether we engage or not. It wasn't a yes, no. It wasn't a light switch that goes on and off. It was a question of how we engage. And could I sleep at night in terms of how we engage in Myanmar? And I set out to make sure that I could sleep at night because we were engaging in a way that would help the situation as much as we possibly could at that time. Now you raise the point that, you know, looking back, was it realistic to think that we could help and go in the right direction? And over time, our understanding of both the willingness and the capacity of the civilian parts of the government to take action became much more nuanced and much more negative. We started out thinking that there would be a strong push to do the right thing, at least from the civilian side of government. And over time, it became clear that they did not have the power, but they also didn't have really the will, in the sense of, you know, public opinion didn't necessarily support a strong push in this direction. So there weren't a lot of incentives to go in that direction. So over time, I think we became more realistic and less optimistic about what we could do. At the same time, I would not have necessarily taken a different course.
Yeah, right. That's a lot to hold and to think through. Yeah, I think this is a perfect time to bring in the element of that civilian government and who they were and what your dealings with them were like, because a large part of your book also goes through that. You mention, for listeners, you do mention in the book that the World Bank typically does not engage with military, and so there were not so many interactions, if any, of dealing with the military counterparts, but that you did have extensive experience with the civilian government, of course, first and foremost in that, and there are other people you get to that we'll talk about, but first and foremost is the lady in any discussion where guests have had interactions with Aung San Suu Kyi, a figure who's been called enigmatic, who has, I'll never forget how one guest described her as kind of a canvas that people put their own colors on and then start to react when the actions that are happening are not the way that the canvas was painted. But in any case, you know, you come in there when she is the Nelson Mandela, you know, the sky high in terms of this political prisoner who now has been empowered somewhat to be able to take on this role, and you're there as her star is starting to fade and to fall, and you don't pull any punches in describing your own sentiments and interactions with her. So talk about Aung San Suu Kyi as a person, as a figurehead, and then as an individual in government that you were dealing with to try to work with.
Yes. She's really quite a tragic figure in my view. But you're absolutely right that we with that description of a blank canvas that we all try to paint on, the way I have described this when I discuss my book is to say that, you know, we all in the so-called international community, we have a tendency to create heroes and villains. In the sense that we imbue individuals like Aung San Suu Kyi with all the values and all the aspirations that we have, and they are heroes for us, and we have huge ambition for them. And then when they fall short of that, they tend to become villains, and we vilify them. And unfortunately, this is not really a good way to conduct foreign policy. Again, if we're looking in the long term and we're looking at what is right for the people of Myanmar, I mean, in the end, that's what it's all about, right? Is the welfare of people in Myanmar, all the people in Myanmar. And if we keep that in mind, rather than the highs and lows of particular personalities, then we tend to maintain a steady course and a beneficial course. If we allow ourselves to be sort of emotionally pulled up and down by our thoughts about these individuals, then we tend to behave, I think, in erratic and emotion-laden ways, like pulling out of Myanmar, when in fact that was not, in my view, the right thing to be doing. But in terms of Aung San Suu Kyi herself, when I first met her, she very clearly had as her top priority peace in the country. And I was not surprised to see that she did not have a highly developed strategy for economic development of the country. And some of our most, I thought, positive discussions that we had with her were very much about the ways in which we could use development as part of a peace dividend. In other words, we could make sure that if the peace process moved forward, you know, that places that were peaceful and that were collaborating in ways that were good for the people of Myanmar, broadly speaking, that World Bank money and projects and programs would benefit those communities in ways that were important, you know, health, education, electricity, roads, small business development, et cetera, et cetera. And she really felt that that was the way to go. The peace dividend was the way to go. And so we did, you know, build our strategy very much around trying to support what we called peaceful and prosperous communities. We wanted to put as much financial incentive as we could around that. However, you know, in terms of dealing with Aung San Suu Kyi, as the Rohingya crisis escalated, and again, we saw repeatedly that she did not obviously have the power to oppose the military directly. At the same time, I felt that she did not have as broad an understanding of the powers that she did have as the head of a civilian part of the government as she might have. And let me give a concrete example of this. I'm not sure that she ever fully understood how much she could influence public opinion around the Rohingya crisis. That if she would start to say the right things, and by the right things, we're talking about, you know, ensuring security on the ground in Rakhine State, eliminating systematic discrimination, a pathway toward citizenship for the Rohingya, creating the conditions for safe, voluntary, and dignified return of the refugees to their places of origin. I mean, I'm using all the buzzwords of the international community of what are the right things that needed to happen in Rakhine State. That she could have swayed public opinion quite a bit on this issue. And I did not see her trying really to do that. So that was quite a disappointment. And as you know, obviously, things like her appearing at the International Court of Justice in a way that felt like a defense of the military, whereas she viewed it as her duty to defend Myanmar. But from the outside world standpoint, it felt like she was speaking as something of an apologist for the atrocities of the military. And that was obviously what was perceived as a fall from grace by the international community. Although, you know, again, inside the country, it played quite differently politically. So all in all, over the time that I was there, there was definitely a slow cooling in our enthusiasm or our conviction that the civilian government would or could act in ways that would justify continued support to resolve the Rohingya crisis.
Right. And this fits into how you characterize it in the book, what you call the NAPIDA consensus, meaning that it would tend towards this continued engagement in quiet diplomacy, flying frequently to NAPIDA, which is the capital, remotely located, and trying to maintain ties, avoid open confrontation in hopes of this gradual change. And this is something that we see heads of agencies and the circuit of ambassadors that are going to try to influence policy in this manner. And yet, as you say, as time went on, I think it started to collectively be understood that the messaging wasn't quite getting through. You describe a lot of detail of your own trips to NAPIDA. I describe it as bizarre and Byzantine and in different places, and make a joke that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, MOFA, that it's actually a minister for foreigners, in the sense that you have Myanmar nationals on your team that are not being allowed in, which was concerning. And so there's a lot here to talk about in terms of the role that the NAPIDA was playing, and that individuals like yourselves, as well as those based largely in Yangon, who I would say have a bit more nuanced understanding of being on the ground, but then those that are flying in, those that are coming more with the moral outrage, with the less sensitive understandings of the complexities of the country, and simply wanting to have their voice heard. All of this happening in NAPIDA. So can you take our listeners into NAPIDA late 2010s and some of your experiences of navigating those halls?
Sure. Let me start by saying, while we didn't at the World Bank work directly with the military in the sense that we don't do anything like military training or provision of arms, et cetera, all of that is not within the scope of our work, we did have extensive experience in the ministries that were controlled by the military. So because our ability to work on the ground in Myanmar depended on that, you know, depended on getting travel authorizations and that kind of thing. So we did have extensive experience. You know, NAPIDA is, as you say, kind of a surreal trip. I would often be on the planes going up at 6 a.m. Along with all the other ambassadors and many of the civil servants who might go down to Yangon for the weekend, up to NAPIDA. At the time, you know, not much traffic on the incredibly wide highways of NAPIDA, wide enough to land a plane, as they say. And it was very surreal in that, you know, you would go to one of many hotels, all of which look the same because they were all built by the military. The ministries all look pretty much the same. And so compared to many other countries, there was a sort of military uniformity to NAPIDA that you don't find in many other governments. And you felt that even when you were visiting with the civilian government. Our interactions, as with every government, you know, no government is a monolith. And we had ministers with whom we felt we had excellent rapport and who were quite progressive, and with whom we could get good things done. Ministers who believed that we should be doing community-driven development out in ethnic states, for example, who were all in favor of everything that we could do to try to not only address the Rohingya situation by doing more work in Rakhine State in those townships that were dominated by the Rohingya, the northern townships, as well as the central townships of Rakhine State, which also have a high Rohingya population. But you know, we had some very progressive, if you will, ministers that were all in favor of the kind of strategic shift that I was talking about, to spend more money and more resources and more effort to reach those that were the most severely deprived in the outer states of the country, essentially the ethnic minorities. However, it was very clear, even for those ministers, that they needed to balance their willingness to entertain that against what they perceived as the political realities. And the political reality is that for, you know, every time we wanted to do something, say in Chin or in Shan or, you know, someplace where, which might have been a very high conflict zone and a very high poverty zone, we had to balance it out with activities in other regions that would be seen as not as being even-handed, if you will, in how we treated different parts of the country. That was seen as politically much more tenable, even though we were pushing for more of a lean toward the outer states.
Mm-hmm. And I want to focus also on, so this is the side of the civilian government that you're referencing, and I want to talk about some of the foreign heads of bureaucracies, of agencies, of development, of embassies and such, and what that position entails. And specifically what I'm thinking is we've spoken to some people on this platform, ambassadors and people from the UN, and they've really stressed how much the individual matters in that context, that sometimes you can have a kind of overall criticism of the organization work from the outside of, and sometimes that's not quite so accurate. It can be hyperbolic, as we've talked about, lacking the nuanced understanding. But that aside, there can also be this sense that that those that are not on the inside of the complexities of decisions to be made, as well as the actual living human personalities and incentives of those individuals, that sometimes there could be a blanket criticism of an organization that, or even a blanket praise of an organization, that really comes down to the people that are in those roles, and that some of those some of these positions and organizations and bureaucracies are set up to potentially, if one wants to lean towards this, incentivize the wrong things and incentivize safety and personal advancement and not rocking the boat. And, you know, when a genocide is happening on your doorstep, you sometimes have to make people feel a little uncomfortable by the words you say and the ways that you push back. And so, you know, for being an individual in this position, it doesn't just take a sense of a moral North Star for knowing what your responsibility is in that role, but it also takes a real courage of being able to shake systems up that aren't set up to respond appropriately to the nature of those unfolding crises. And so, in other words, this is just all coming back to that understanding that people matter, individual personalities matter, however these organizations are structured, are set up, and whatever their mandates and their protocols and missions and objectives and everything else, it's still, I would argue, and I think this comes out in your book, it still comes down to the people that are set in leading them and what they're incentivized to do and what they end up doing. And so, as someone who, you know, was in this position yourself, I'm sure had mentors, good and bad examples of when you were a junior in these organizations, as well as those relationships that you would have to develop across agencies and diplomatic missions. What's your thought on just the value of that individual makeup and how that complexity played out in Myanmar at this time?
Yeah, great question. One of the few very clear takeaways from my 40 years on the front line of foreign aid delivery is that individuals matter and leaders matter. And by this, I mean that what gets messaged from the top is remarkably important. And that's why I was stressing a moment ago that I felt that Aung San Suu Kyi could have done more in terms of her messaging and her outreach to her people to shape and to mold public opinion in a way that might have led to better response. But this goes way beyond my time in Myanmar. And as I said, it's something that I learned through 40 years of working all over Africa, Europe, Asia, is that even in the most constrained situations, the most difficult systems, the most complicated, conflict-ridden environments, there are individuals who want to do something positive and who are able to motivate and mobilize others to do it. And it is remarkable what they can accomplish in those situations, even against really difficult odds. And I've seen this over and over again. And so this is something that I tell, I lecture many graduate students in international development now, and this is a message that I give them as well, that there are good people everywhere and good work to be done everywhere, and it can be done in some of the most difficult circumstances. So that's a very positive message, I think, a very hopeful message. And it certainly is true of Myanmar now, in the resistance, when we see that that individuals have accomplished way beyond what I think most of the world felt that they could accomplish in trying to oppose the military junta.
Now, I want to come back to your book and its title, partly because so much of this follows through with our conversation, and partly just to remind listeners again to check it out and get a copy, because there's a lot in there to learn, and we're not able to cover all of it. But damned if you do. And of course, the for non-native English speakers who might not be familiar with the expression, there's the English expression, damned if you do, damned if you don't, meaning that you don't have a good decision in front of you. In the face in Myanmar, this is indicating that agencies like World Bank have a choice of seeming to do nothing in the face of evil to avoid any complicity, and then abandoning vulnerable populations and losing any chance at positive influence, which is a moral failure of a mission. Or on the other choice, being able to stay and act, and then they risk legitimizing or enabling these abusive regimes, which is a moral failure of commission. And this is, you express this double bind vividly in the case of the Rohingya crisis in the book. And as you jumping ahead to when you, whatever word one wants to use, when you were forced out, or when you left, or when you were, your engagement with World Bank, came to a close, that you made the remark, that it was a feeling of being punished for failing to stop a genocide.
I was, in fact, forced out of the World Bank, or asked to leave, I guess might be another way to put it, over the discussions in Myanmar. And what really happened is that I was criticized by the World Bank bureaucracy for not being able to solve the problem, not being able to get through to Aung San Suu Kyi. I think many ambassadors and heads of agencies were criticized by their headquarters, thinking, you know, how hard could it possibly be? You know, go talk to her. Surely she's a democracy icon. She's won a Nobel Peace Prize. She understands what needs to happen. Why can't you people, you know, get this through to her? So criticized within my own organization, criticized by the government, even the, you know, certainly the military, but also by the civilian government, as the World Bank, for seemingly getting involved in what they viewed as political issues that were not part of our mandate, right? They were used to the United Nations having a Human Rights Commission and you know, UNHCR talking about the refugees, but they viewed the World Bank as, you know, you're economics, you're technocratic, don't bother us with, you know, these thoughts about genocide and human rights and social welfare. So criticized by the government, and then finally criticized by human rights activists, because by staying engaged, and there are many examples in the book of, you know, we would meet with Rohingya groups, and those Rohingya groups would beg the World Bank, would ask the World Bank to stay involved, stay on the ground in Rakhine, offer, you know, some resources to Rohingya communities that they could use to build their communities in various ways. But any work that we did, especially in Rakhine State, I mean, some even went so far as to say any work we did in Myanmar was viewed as being complicit in what was not yet being termed a genocide, but which later, for example, the U.S. would term a genocide. So you couldn't win. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. You really could not win. It was, as I describe in the book, becoming an unwinnable position. And again, you know, I feel that I lost the battle in that ultimately I lost my job because of so much opposition coming from all these different directions. But at the same time, in a way, I won a bigger war because not only did the World Bank choose to follow the strategy that I felt was the right one, which was to be engaged in a different way, a way that actually empowered the ethnic minorities and tilted our resources toward dealing, you know, toward overcoming their exclusion and their severe deprivation. The World Bank continued on with that strategy and adopted that strategy enthusiastically, but even broader than Myanmar. After I left the World Bank, those who deal with fragile and conflict-affected states wrote a new strategy, and a main pillar of that new strategy was to never disengage, to stay engaged, but to engage in ways that would drive forward the right values or the right kinds of development that we need to see in those states. So I feel there was something of a victory, not so much for Myanmar, obviously, but in a broader sense, in terms of how we engage in these very, very difficult situations.
That's really interesting. And so, because part of what you write is a criticism just of how development and aid comes out in the international community, especially in fragile and conflict zones, and that it shouldn't be siloed, and that that it should be tied to other developments. That segues into another question that I had is going into that criticism and perspective of where there needs to be a policy change. And this is something we've certainly covered with guests in talking about Hugo Slim's ideas of humanitarian resistance, looking at ASEAN and Thailand and what they could and should be doing in terms of where different humanitarian aid and projects can be going outside the SAC administered areas and in contemporary post-coup Myanmar, which, you know, as the military controls just 20-30%. So why is everything going to military channels where they're certainly not going to be helping those people that they're trying to suffocate and persecute as an intentional strategy on their part? And so getting into that part from your perspective, that desire to not want to have these things siloed and to have them more integrated, you're saying that at least as far as the World Bank is concerned, you feel that the test case that Myanmar provided, even though Myanmar itself couldn't benefit from that perspective and that argument, you feel that post-Myanmar, that the World Bank has adapted and integrated some of these concerns into its mission going forward.
Yes, some. It was a win. I mean, we have to take our wins where we can get them, especially in the world today. But there are really three big messages that I feel come out of the book. And these are things that I like to discuss with people in the business. The first is what we were talking about just a moment ago, which is the West you know, the US and the Western liberal democracies, we really need to adapt to a multipolar world and approach these situations with humility, in that it just, we have only limited financial, political, moral clout, and we should not disengage. We need to stay engaged, otherwise we lose all ability to influence and shape the globe. Now, with the sort of restructuring of the world order now, we have to remain extremely agile to figure out who's going to be supporting what. But from, I think this just heightens the view that we need to stay engaged for the long run. So that's one of the main messages. The other main message, as you were just alluding to, is that, we need to move beyond what has been an extremely country-based and an extremely government-centric foreign aid architecture. And, this has endured since after World War II. And yet we're in a situation where more and more of the problems need to be solved above the country level, thinking of climate change, pandemics, et cetera, and yet we don't have the mechanisms for both financing and collective action above the country level, and this is the case that for Myanmar, and also below the country or national government level, to deal more with non-state actors, local actors. I mean, as I tell people in talking about Myanmar, when I would come back to headquarters, to my headquarters for the World Bank, but also to the U.S. Congress and the U.S. State Department here in Washington, what I would find at the time is I would talk about ethnic armed organizations, which are now called ethnic resistance organizations. And the immediate assumption, because of the word armed, I suppose, was that these are the bad guys, that these are armed groups who are out to somehow destroy Myanmar, when in fact, these were the good guys. And I would have to point this out all the time to people, that we're talking about groups that are fighting for the rights of people in Myanmar. I mean, we have to remember that this is not just about the Rohingya. It's actually true that 1 in 5 people in Myanmar lack full citizenship rights. And that doesn't include the Rohingya, who are considered stateless. So there are huge numbers of people in Myanmar of various ethnic backgrounds who do not have full citizenship rights and who are suffering from exclusion and discrimination. So, we really need to be able to work with non-state actors and now, of course, after the coup, we need to think again, not only about what we should be doing and how we should be engaging with the parts of the country that are controlled by the junta without doing business with the junta, and at the same time, how do we support the resistance and the people who are living in the areas that are controlled by the resistance movement, especially at a time like this when they're suffering from the effects of the earthquake on top of all of the military bombardments and things that are going on. So that's my second message, is that the aid architecture in general just has to be able to focus above the country level, but also below the country level, and working with both governmental and other non-state kinds of actors. And then the last big message that comes out for me and may feel a little bit, I don't know, far-fetched at this moment in our history, but that is that we need to move beyond electoral politics, but actually lean into the concept of democratic governance. And what I mean by that is, through any foreign aid interventions, whether you're the World Bank or you're, CETA or you're Japanese aid or whatever group is providing foreign aid, we need to lean into the hallmarks of democracy, which are participation, transparency, and accountability. And Myanmar has suffered decades without adequate attention to these areas, beyond strictly the Rohingya. I mean, in terms of participation, as I said, you know, 1 in 5 people in the country do not have full citizenship rights. You know, accountability, the military has never been accountable to a civilian government or to the people. These are things that must change in Myanmar, but also in the larger world as we go forward, you know, trying to do development or to provide foreign aid. Those of us in the rest of the world, I think, really need, you know, not to retreat from doing what is right, but actually to lean into doing what is right.
That's a great breakdown and analysis, bringing from the pages of your book. And looking at how the World Bank then moved on from taking Myanmar as a lesson to integrate some positive examples from that, I'd like to look at the wider UN, and which I think is also especially pertinent right now as it comes to the decisions that some UN agencies are making in Myanmar post-coup. You describe in your book the UN Human Rights Council fact-finding mission, looking into engagement at that time, and the report actually criticizing some UN agencies are sidelining human rights concerns in favor of development and access. And you describe this as the snake eating its own tail. This is a constant question. This question of, I mean, we're going back to this question of staying and engaging, or removing and being able to work outside the system. And in this case, I think it's looking back at those years, it's it wasn't a question of the UN really staying or going. It was a question of prioritizing relations and development and access and all of those good things with kind of the messy and sensitive terrain of human rights with marginalized communities and democratic norms and things like that, that maybe can just not talk about or sweep away these uncomfortable areas to be able to continue developing some of those others. And the FFM, I think rightly so, pointed out and criticized that engagement and that decision to engage in that matter. And I think this also comes back very much to, you know, who is in these positions. The UN is not monolith by any means. It's a vast network of different agencies and different individuals that are heading those agencies. That being said, looking at it today, there has been, and this might be one of those views of the outside looking in that's maybe not understanding the situation as clearly as the nuanced views of those inside, but a criticism and kind of a moral outrage from outside that so many of these UN agencies, and we can also say big international relief organizations, are keeping their office for whatever reason in the SAC-controlled areas of Myanmar, keeping up their relationships with the military, the photo ops that you see going up on social media from time to time, knowing knowing very well the limited success they're going to be having at being able to do anything of value outside SAC control channels. And so this is a general question, because you're talking about a swath of years and a lot of organizations and heads of organizations and agencies. So it might be a nuanced answer, but we do have to say that, you know, 2025 is very different from 2017. The conditions and the considerations that one has, it is a very different landscape.
First of all, let me start by saying, when there is a coup d'etat and when there is an illegitimate government, which is the case in Myanmar today under this SAC, you basically, at the World Bank, there is a clear policy where that leads to the freezing of the portfolio and a halt on all new operations. So the World Bank still has an office in Yangon, a much smaller office at this point. They have taken the director out of Myanmar, and that's not accidental. The director is back in Bangkok. And the World Bank is engaging in analytic work and is also executing trust funds, meaning grant money, not loans, grant money for largely humanitarian and social welfare purposes executed by United Nations agencies. I just want to be clear on that because there's a lot of confusion about how the World Bank is engaged. And of course, what that means is that there are UN agencies that are executing projects on the ground in areas controlled by the SAC. So, and it's the same as story that it's always been, that you have organizations like WFP and FAO that are on the ground and they're doing things entirely through civil society organizations, non-governmental organizations, and all of that. And these are useful activities. Now, at some level, and I can't say because I have had no contact myself with these organizations in the past few years, but obviously if they're operating in those areas, they are at least logistically engaged with the military. The military must give them travel authorizations to operate. They are not working through the military. They are not working through the ministries per se. The ministries are not executing anything. So in many respects, they are not engaging with the military. Again, I just want to get the facts out there so that people aren't misinterpreting what is going on there. It's by no means business as usual for the World Bank or for other UN agencies in the junta-controlled parts of Myanmar. I think the real question, let me say two things. One is that I think there's room for players that work inside, and there's room for players that work outside, and we need both. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing I want to say is related, and that is that I think the real question is how we organize ourselves to support the parts of the country that are not under SAC control. And that, as you have pointed out, is a bigger and bigger part of the country, or at least it's a debatable part of the country. Most countries have some mechanisms for that kind of support. Bilaterals who give grants are more able to work entirely through non-governmental, non-state civil society organizations. They should maximize that. The United States, as you know, was working in a very minimal way inside the country, inside the junta-controlled territories, but also had many programs running in through other channels other than the State Department to support aspects of the resistance, everything from supporting social services or job creation to all the way up to non-lethal military support for resistance fighters. So from my standpoint, I think the real question should be, are we doing enough to support the resistance, both from a political standpoint and from a military standpoint? And what are the mechanisms? They tend not to be very good or very well organized or very visible to support the resistance. But I think that that's really where we need to focus our attention, particularly as the more traditional aid architecture is having a moment of sort of breakdown and chaos, at least in the United States and also, declines in other countries. I think we need to really start looking at alternative ways to reach and support the resistance.
And just to put a bow in this conversation about the Rohingya crisis and during your time there, the actions and plans and strategies that you were looking to enact, we spoke a lot about when the Rohingya crisis was starting to flare up and then your relations with the international community, with the other stakeholders, with World Bank officials, with the civilian government. But the one part I realized we didn't get to in describing is what policies you were looking to do at the World Bank as this Rohingya crisis developed and worsened, and looking at from your mechanisms and your mission, what were you able to do that would have an impact? What did you try to do, and how did that develop?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Well, what we were trying to do through our portfolio and also potentially with new operations was to tilt more of the financing and more of the technical support to activities on the outer ring of the country in those areas that were demonstrably the most severely deprived. And we had excellent data, literally township by township, that showed the multiple deprivations of different populations. So it wasn't hard to know where we needed to target our assistance. What was much more difficult was to get the political buy-in from all sides, from the Myanmar side and then also from our shareholders, on how to do that. The reality of the situation is that although we never at the World Bank at the time, from mid 2017 onward, we never took an official decision to freeze our new lending, but we also never actually went ahead with any new lending for almost 2 years while we debated and talked about what should be the right policy and how do we send the right messages and how should we be, you know, tilting our resources for best advantage. So, but the team got very busy and developed a wide, you know, we developed new operations. For example, I believe I mentioned earlier the Peaceful and Prosperous Communities Project, which was essentially geared toward community-driven development type interventions focused on conflict-affected areas that were choosing peace, basically, or that could be pushed along, if you will, or incentivized to choose peace and to move forward through this kind of development intervention. So we defined a lot of different operations like that. We even had a potential operation for Rakhine State that was in our heads, but was conditional, obviously, on progress made as judged by UNHCR and the UN system on doing those right things in Rakhine about restoring security, eliminating systematic discrimination, and creating the conditions, appropriate conditions for refugee return. So that never got anywhere, as those conditions have not been established to date. And in fact, the situation is extremely messy in Rakhine, as most of your listeners know. So basically, we tried very hard, and it wasn't until about 2 years later that we were able, and it was after I was gone, that we were able to take some of those projects that had been envisioned to our board, and they were approved. And the ones that went first, one was an education project that basically provides stipends to disadvantaged children to go to school. And there were very extremely tight mechanisms in place to ensure that children of ethnic minorities were able to access schools, were able to go safely to school, and that we could monitor that they were actually attending school. The other operation that was able to go through was a maternal and child health operation that again used transfers of resources directly to mothers, pregnant women and mothers of young children related to nutrition behaviors and health behaviors to try to reduce the what is really an epidemic of stunting among young children in Myanmar. So we were able to do some very good things, but with a long delay. And it was almost impossible to directly help the Rohingya population. I will say that. And that remains something that I feel a lot of regret over.
Those are quite strong words to speak honestly, as the head of the World Bank in Myanmar at that time, that that this became something you determined impossible to do. And I think this also touches upon a comment I made earlier of the more I look back at this period of the would have, could have, the would have, could have, should haves of the moment, I personally have a sense of pessimism for knowing what the vibe was like at that time. I don't really know what anyone from any perspective really could have done to shift things given the dynamics that were at play. And, you know, those are largely domestic dynamics, but again, we have to keep bringing in Facebook, you know, and the role that the militarized propaganda was playing on this new technology taking over, and you know, really just kind of pouring gasoline on a fire that was already burning. So you know,
yeah, I may disappoint you by not feeling as harsh about Facebook as I think most people do. I recognize that they were a platform that was filled with propaganda and hate speech and things posted by many, including by the military itself. I also have to balance that against the remarkable transformation of the information environment in Myanmar from, you know, 2010 to say 2020. And the fact, for better or for worse, people went from having no information and having less than 3% of the population having access to any kind of telephone to, you know, 95% of the population having a smartphone. And therefore, we have to give some credit, I think, to social media as being one of the ways in which information just became widespread. And I feel that this really broke open society and linked, you know, people in Myanmar to the larger world in a way that has served the resistance extremely well. And so I have a more mitigated view of that.
Sure. Yeah, it's a mixed bag for sure, and that's a debate for another episode. We've certainly had our share of digital security and online experts that have come on. So the book that you've written, this book is it's very raw. It's very emotional. It doesn't pull punches. It's coming from your perspective, but it's really invested in knowing that that's your perspective and putting that out there for all to see, for better, for worse, for agreement or not. But, you know, certainly it doesn't leave any mistake that this is what you felt and saw and did during that time. And so I should say it also, it stands out of books I've read and just the tone itself of how it's replaying these events that we're all familiar with from your particular standpoint of the World Bank, but it is, you know, it definitely carries a certain tone, which I would believe is intentional to have things really come out in a much stronger and more raw manner than one might be accustomed to in reading memoirs or books of this nature. And so I'm wondering what response you've received from those that have read it, both pushing back as well as those who have appreciated it.
I've been really blown away and pleasantly surprised by the feedback that I have gotten. And I think it sort of falls into a number of different categories. From people who are current or past staff members of the World Bank, I have gotten hugely positive feedback that this is must reading, if you will, for students of international development or young practitioners, because this is how it really is. This shows the complexity of moral decision making and how at the end you have, you know, whatever information you've got, and then you have your personal set of values. And a lot of times you have to make decisions based on that because you're not really getting much help from your institution or from the people around you or and so gotten very positive feedback there. Have also heard from a wide range of development practitioners from other parts of the world and diplomats from other parts of the world, all saying, you know, I've been there. That while Myanmar was kind of a microcosm of all of these issues and a very extreme case of the complexities of decision making in conflict-affected countries and in difficult political environments. This is a universal story. This is something that every diplomat and development practitioner has experienced to some degree. Now, I will say that I spent over a year discussing this book with the World Bank because they weren't too happy about publication. And at the same time, I was under, as a former staff member, I was under an obligation to have it reviewed by the World Bank. And there were parts of the World Bank that simply for questions of reputational risk, or it would open up sensitive things in our dialogue now in Southeast Asia. You know, many, many different arguments were made, including that I was putting our local staff potentially at risk. So there were voices in the World Bank that did not want it published. At the same time, there were other voices that said, well, not everything is, you know, is a secret, and that not everything that we need to operate from the standpoint of things that are not prohibited by policy are allowed, and therefore we need to let this book go forward. And I'm very grateful to the World Bank for ultimately allowing it to go forward, because I think it does show what the reality is like. All of these institutions have aspects, you know, that don't look so good in terms of internal politics, risk aversion, you know, political agendas, personal agendas that get in the way. So it doesn't always look pretty, but this is the sausage being made, as we say. I mean, this is the part you don't necessarily want to see, but it's the reality for those that want to work in the field. And I think it's an opportunity by reading the book. You do get a sense of ways in which we need to change the way we deliver foreign aid, the way we try to do development in the world. And that's, you know, that's the challenge and the opportunity for the next generation.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for taking time for this interview. And I just want to close with a personal question, because we've talked so much about your professional capacity in Myanmar, but no question about your personal capacity there. You're also an individual who lived there with your family for a number of years, and that's after a long international career of being in many other countries. And so I'd like to ask you, what stands out? What personal memories and experiences do you have from Myanmar, the people, the culture, the country, that you would like to share here on Ending Note?
I have absolutely wonderful memories of Myanmar, and I also have absolutely wonderful friendships that have continued to this day in Myanmar. The book talks about, for example, my godchild, who was born while I was in Myanmar, and she remains an important part of my life even to this day. So I think the thing that stays with me the most, of course, is just how wonderfully warm, kind and open I found the people of Myanmar, in various states and regions. I got to travel the whole country. So the people are certainly wonderful people, kind people, devoted to their families and to their friends. I mean, people really take care of each other, and I think that's wonderful. The other thing that stands out for me is I did have the privilege to see much of the country and to travel through this country. And it is an absolute cultural treasure. I mean, I know its nickname is the Golden Land, and indeed it's golden in many, many ways. It's not just the gold on top of the stupas and the pagodas, but it's also just the beautiful scenery, the lakes, the villages. It's all absolutely gorgeous. And I really look forward to going back to Myanmar in the near future.
thank you for listening to this episode in full. You know, by this point, we've aired a few hundred episodes, with many more scheduled, and every single one of them is available at no charge. We are committed to keeping our platform freely accessible into the foreseeable future so that anyone, anywhere, can learn about the situation in Myanmar. At a time when keeping global awareness on the country is so critical, it's more important than ever to share these stories widely. So to ensure that we can continue offering these programs without any barriers or paywalls in the way, we've launched a membership program. Becoming a member not only helps us in this drive to sustain our platform and bring you more vital interviews, it also comes with benefits like advanced releases, behind-the-scenes content, exclusive discounts at our shop, and more. So if you'd like to support us and gain access to these perks, visit insightmyanmar.org/membership to learn more. Thank you for being a part of this mission. Of course, we also welcome contributions of any kind as well, and invite you to visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to learn more about the ways that you can contribute.
Yaran angka yau nyana dadu ya dalam diri ganen zat mana wika dah besi yana besi yo. Hoba yaran anda dah yana nangan dah yana yada yana nampot apa yana mana.